Welcome to the Open Scroll audio series. The study you're about to hear was written by Bob Schlenker and is being read by Aaron Herman. Since the time of its recording, this study's been retitled from Beyond the Veil to When Cometh That Thief in the Night. This is the study called The Night of Seven Watches.
Students of Bible prophecy give plenty of attention to what's familiar to most as Daniel's 70th week, a set of 7 years that must be seen as pivotal. And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Daniel 9, verse 27. Reference is made to this passage, and also to Daniel 11, verse 31, and chapter 12, verse 11, to establish a connection in Matthew 24, another primary text about the last days. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Matthew 24, verses 15 and 16. The Bible has plenty to reveal about what will happen during this week and when, and this is our interest in this structured overview, as attention is given to those events and dynamics. Captain Obvious here. There's more that I don't know than what I think I do, yet I believe what is represented here is fit for the season. What I thought I knew back in 1991, when the Lord took me to his feet and began to instruct me in the matter of the hope, turned out to be far less than I actually knew, as the Lord demonstrated to me in memorable ways. It was like I had been seeing with the light of a 20-watt bulb, but then suddenly with a 150-watt bulb. After revealing the celestial sign of Jacob's deathbed prophecy, he began to open to me many other things about how the end times would unfold, and with the relationship between key events being exposed, light was brightly shining upon the meaning of the events. I learned from profoundly detailed allegories in such places as Genesis 45 and Acts 12. This came in combination with learning how shadows of the big transitional events had been embedded in the historical record. With insight into the hidden meaning of Psalm 90, verse 4, I understood how the threefold model of great sevens is a marvelous and elegant provision. This focal period is identified in Daniel as 1-7, week, or Shavuah in the Hebrew, famine week or night of seven watches. These are other fitting labels. According to the accounting on the Lord's calendar, we have learned to identify it as the Shemitah numbering 860 in the count from Adam, abbreviated F.A. So, again, what will happen during this week and when? I see as through a glass darkly, and there is far more that is yet to be revealed. Yet, there are some things that must be declared. I have varying degrees of confidence about the material, which I will note. The Shemitah begins. Many students of prophecy read Daniel 9, verse 27, and see the declaration of a sign that is widely interpreted as a peace treaty made with Israel for a 7-year term. And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. A recent example, Russia arranging peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. Is this the Daniel 9:27 deal? Whatever Daniel is conveying isn't claimed to be a sign. It has been assumed that it is, and perhaps it will be. I have never received revelation insight about this. Perhaps the most useful information I can offer is an account of what has been witnessed while on watch through the turns of the Shemitah. In the very notable fall season of 1991, President George H.W. Bush was in the news with plenty of momentum, trying to put a deal together that had the look of what was generally expected by prophecy pundits. The Madrid conference began on October 30th, with some consequences for Bush's attempt to broker the State of Israel's land being noted by John McTiernan. But this effort was ultimately seen as not having been very effective. In 1998, at the beginning of the Second Shemitah, an account from the Celestial Sign of 1991, Bill Clinton had a similar deal in the works. The Y River Memorandum was a political agreement negotiated to implement the Oslo Accords, completed on 23rd October 1998. It was signed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat. It was negotiated at Y River, Maryland, at the Y River Conference Center, and signed at the White House with President Bill Clinton as the official witness. On 17th November 1998, Israel's 120-member parliament, the Knesset, approved the Y River Memorandum by a vote of 75-19, according to Wikipedia. In 2005, as the next Shemitah got underway, Bill Clinton was once again right at the center of the signal activity. Clinton's global initiative was launched, with the inaugural meeting taking place in New York City on September 15th through the 17th, 2005. The launch began on Yom Kippur. Yom Terah was September 6th, 2005. The CGI was, at least superficially, all about getting leaders to make promises and giving a show of accountability for following through. What I've decided to do is have a smaller meeting around the opening of the UN, discuss just four topics every year, and then tell everyone that comes at the end of the 2 days, you have to make a personal commitment to take some action in one of these four areas. I figured if I could get really good people who are going to be able to have a big impact in the world over the next decade to come together once a year for 10 years and actually sign a pledge to take action themselves, if we did that every year for 10 years, we could do a lot of good in the world. Pledges were signed. Covenants. With many. They had their 10-year stretch. 11, actually. And in the 12th session, a time number, they're shutting it down. To avoid conflicts of interest with Hillary's presidency. There's some curly quotes in there somewhere. The typical controversy has attended the Antichrist contenders' activities. In 2005, the inaugural CGI overlapped the UN's Millennium Plus 5 summit, which ran from September 14th through the 16th, and Bill's stated intention for his event was to complement the summit. The summit was the first plenary meeting of the UN General Assembly 60th session. The stated agenda for the Millennium Plus 5 summit was to evaluate the progress made towards the United Nations Millennium Declaration that was adopted by over 150 heads of state at the September 2000 UN Millennium Summit. In so doing, the world's leaders reaffirmed their faith in the organization and its charter as indispensable foundations of a more peaceful, prosperous, and just world. More timely modeling of Daniel 9, verse 27? Perhaps. In 2012, when the prime Shemitah finally arrived and the things foreshadowed and prophesied were expected, what we witnessed instead was simply more of the same. Clinton's global initiative and the UN meetings. Yom Terah was 9/18/2012, and the CGI met from 9/23 to 9/25. It was a huge disappointment. Beyond puzzling. Time was skewed sideways, and the prophetic schedule was deferred, pending a reset. Back then, we had learned about a coming reset, but still had no awareness of how it would be reset into the past. I don't have much more to offer about the beginning of the pivotal Shemitah, except to note that, in the record of creation, light was brought forth on the first day, which suggests that we should anticipate that light will manifest in that first watch of the night, in either an exoteric or esoteric sense, or in both senses. When the sun sets, the stars come out. The flood divider, 1.5, 5.5. According to the threefold model of great sevens, we can project the flood of Noah's day, which was 1656 through 57 from Adam, into the early second half of the second watch of the night. I don't have revelation insight into what biblical event of significance is appointed, but I can offer observations that seem relevant. Any event that compares on some level with the great flood of Noah's day seems likely to have a substantial impact. Many biblical passages containing the word flood are heart-rending transcripts of the cries and prayers of those affected by a kind of flooding. The fourth verse of Psalm 90 establishes the template of the Night Watch week, and the very next verse makes reference to a people who have been swept away like a flood. For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. You have swept them away like a flood, they fall asleep. In the morning they are like grass which sprouts anew. Psalm 90, verses 4 and 5. The language of the verses that follow it harken back to the circumstances of the flood of Noah's day. The following passage informs us about a more localized flood that is appointed for the night watch week. And the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman, so that he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river which the dragon poured out of his mouth. Revelation 12, verses 15 and 16. Is this what compares to the flood of Noah's day? I don't believe so, because of the timing cues. You'll find more discussion of this and other matters of relevant interest in this study called A Flood Like and Unlike Noah's. In Seasons of Watching, I didn't give this much attention until this Shemitah came and the antitype, or event itself, was anticipated. It seemed more and more likely that the Black Awakening was part of the deal, or perhaps America's horn being broken off and a subsequent pandemic. But it was not to be. We had no idea that time had been hijacked and that the prophetic schedule had been subverted, so this failure to witness the flood-shattered event on the correct scale was disturbing and confusing, because the Lord kept strongly encouraging us to carry on. What we did see was a wonky set of signs, like might have been appropriate in the preceding Shemitah cycles as shadows of the event echo into the past, but slightly out of phase. The following unedited posts were published during that watch season, which, depending on how it's calculated, falls in the range of May 5th through the 18th of 2014. The one on the bottom is most interesting. Those are titled Signs of the Season, Noah Sails Past Jacob as a Blue Baby Born and Stephen Jones's Observations, While on Watch, Signs of a Counter Flood, Signs in the Earth, Report of May 15, and Initial Observations While on Watch in the Projected Flood Season. The Exodus Divider, 2.5 and 4.5. This third watch of the night stands out as the one I have the most confidence in, because it has been made to be my primary focus, and so much has been revealed about it that is redundant in ways that naturally provide for cross-checking. The prophetic scenarios presented in the directory, as piercing the veil, cast their brilliant light upon this division of the third watch of the night. The bride theft study is a standout, and these others with it. What will their acceptance be but life from the dead? The Sign for the Bride, Part 1. When will the Lawless One be revealed? The Sign for the Bride, Part 2. What will happen at this time on our calendar, in the post-reset restored timeline, spring of 2015? According to the harvest allegory, it will be the antitype barley harvest followed by the wheat harvest. For a brief sketch, a key sequence of events begins with a trigger, the baptism of the Lawless One by the papal false prophet. The bride will watch for that on the 13th day of the first month, and recognize it as a special sign, setting about the business of exposing, as a fraud, the one who will be wildly celebrated by the world. A faction of Israel, numbering 144,000, gives this matter of the messianic identity their attention. While the world persecutes and dismisses the claims of the hated bride, her witness moves those 144,000 sons of Israel to envy and they turn to accept the bridegroom Yeshua as their promised Messiah. Their acceptance on the 21st day of the first month, the last day of Pesach, prompts the bridegroom, at this transitional moment, to steal his barley bride away to his father's house. There's a private meeting of Yeshua and his beloved family in his heavenly quarters, where testimony is given. A meal is shared, and there is an equipping and commissioning. A joint mission then results in another faction of Israel coming to accept Yeshua as their Messiah, triggering another harvest at Shavuot of the wheat. The following passage in Hosea applies to the millennial week and to the night watch Shemitah. Indeed, the reference to the spring rains in connection with the Lord's appearing suggests that a particular week of years is the most fitting context in which this prophecy will be fulfilled. Come, let us return to the Lord. He has torn us to pieces, but he will heal us. He has injured us, but he will bind up our wounds. After 2 days he will revive us. On the third day he will restore us, that we may live in his presence. Let us acknowledge the Lord. Let us press on to acknowledge him. As surely as the sun rises, he will appear. He will come to us like the winter rains, like the spring rains that water the earth. Hosea 6, verses 1 through 3. According to the threefold model of great sevens, we reflect upon how the third day of creation is easily seen to be divided in two. This is a pronounced division. The view is that of a habitat being prepared that is subsequently followed by the appearance of creatures to inhabit it. From the millennial week, what is very exactly projected into the midst of the third night watch is Israel's exodus from Egypt and 2448 from Adam, and entrance into the Promised Land. Do you perceive a common theme? Reflect on Hosea 6, verse 2 above, and on John 13, verse 3, in the context of the appearance of new life to inhabit a prepared place. Do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you. For I go to prepare a place for you. If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way where I am going. John 14, verses 1 through 4. So, on the third day he will restore us, that we may live in his presence. What was witnessed during the intense watch season in this prime Shemitah can be read in the unedited posts published during April 2015. It was an intense season where we received some visions and touches of glory and dramatic signs and memorable discipline and further promise. Instead of the antitypical events, of course, we witnessed a variety of out-of-phase kinds of signs. While on watch earlier during these night watches, Aaron witnessed a dramatic sign that is worth noting here. The kitchen wall clock that looks like an apple fell on the floor, coming off the wall in an impossible way. Time stopped in a figure. I heard it fall, having just gone upstairs to bed. Even though this event didn't come at the 2.5 demarcation, it still happened at the transition into the second day year on Yom Terah in 2014, precisely 2 years in. You can read about it in these two posts to the blog. The sign of Yom Terah, falling apple clock, Antichrist, and the time mission. The sign of Yom Terah, stopped clock, Russ Dizdar, agent of light and shadow. Some 2-5 divisions featured in cryptic prophecies. When we search for other sets of seven to learn how they might be divided, we found 5 accounts. In each case, the 7 are divided into whole number sets of 2 and 5. There is no variance. 2 of these accounts feature children, 1 fishermen and 2 food items. Each of these accounts is a prophetic allegory picturing the watches in the night. She who is barren has borne 7 children. Briefly, 1 Samuel 2 lays the foundation for Samuel as a type of the 144,000. His parents, Hannah and Elkanah, represent Israel and the church, The famine week is seen in symbolism as the seven children born by she who is barren. Those who were full hire themselves out for food, but those who were hungry hunger no more. She who is barren has borne seven children, but she who has had many sons pines away. The Lord brings death and makes alive. He brings down to the grave and raises up. The Lord sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts. 1 Samuel 2, verses 5 through 7. The name Hannah means he was gracious. 1 Samuel 2, verse 21a reads, "And the Lord was gracious to Hannah," which expanded reads, "And the Lord was gracious to he was gracious." Our attention is drawn to the verse because the meaning of the name is found right there, and this has become a familiar device for the calling out of a hidden prophecy. This verse is the one in which the rest of Hannah's children are mentioned, and there's an apparent discrepancy regarding her children that suggests that there is a riddle to be solved. Here's the whole verse. "And the Lord was gracious to Hannah. She conceived and gave birth to three sons and two daughters. Meanwhile, the boy Samuel grew up in the presence of the Lord." 1 Samuel 2, verse 21. Let's do the math. Samuel plus three sons makes four, add two daughters, and the sum is six children. Where's the seventh child? There's no further information anywhere to be found in the Bible, so we're left with a curiosity about the number of children. Here's my understanding of the riddle. When the prophecy is given that she who is barren has borne seven children, the children are to be understood in the sense that is consistent with the esoteric context. It looks to me as though the seven are grouped into two, Samuel and the mysteriously missing child, and then five, three sons and two daughters. Saul receives two of seven sacrificial gifts at the Oak of Tabor. If you do the math on the exchange at the Oak of Tabor, described in verses 3 and 4, the men going up to God at Bethel gave Saul two of the seven items they carried, leaving them with five. Then Samuel took the flask of oil, poured it on his head, kissed him, and said, "Has not the Lord anointed you a ruler over his inheritance? When you go from me today, then you will find two men close to Rachel's tomb in the territory of Benjamin at Zelzah. And they will say to you, 'The donkeys which you went to look for have been found. Now behold, your father has ceased to be concerned about the donkeys, and is anxious for you, saying, What shall I do about my son?' Then you will go on further from there, and you will come as far as the Oak of Tabor. And there three men going up to God at Bethel will meet you, one carrying three young goats, another carrying three loaves of bread, and another carrying a jug of wine. And they will greet you and give you two loaves of bread, which you will accept from their hand. Afterward, you will come to the hill of God where the Philistine garrison is, and it shall be as soon as you have come there to the city that you will meet a group of prophets coming down from the high place with harp, tambourine, flute, and a lyre before them, and they will be prophesying. Then the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you mightily, and you shall prophesy with them, and be changed into another man. It shall be, when these signs come to you, do for yourself what the occasion requires, for God is with you. And you shall go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You shall wait 7 days until I come to you, and show you what you should do." 1 Samuel 10, verses 1 through 8. Having become familiar with many coded prophetic scenarios, several elements in this passage suggest that it's an esoteric text pertaining to the third watch of the night, speaking to me of the bride theft and the sealing of the 144,000 sons of Israel. 7 days are mentioned. The jug of wine is the seventh item listed, signifying the Shabbat rest that follows the work week of 6 days. Donkeys are often representing angels. The Spirit of the Lord comes on Saul mightily, and he will be changed into another man. A transformation as from the flesh to spirit body. Benjamin is a type of the bride. The men with the prophetic sacrificial gifts are going up to God at Bethel, the house of God, as ascending into heaven. After receiving the bread, Saul comes to the hill of God, as another reference to heaven, while the Philistine garrison is as the iron gate of Acts 12. While other spiritual men are coming down from the high place, as from heaven itself, with musical accompaniment. Saul's seven male descendants. These seven children are found in the context of the payment of the penalty for his sin. Saul had sinned against the Lord and brought a famine upon the land as a consequence. Saul is recognized by some as a symbol of the wheat/Shavuot church. These seven are his sons, sacrificed to pay a penalty for his sin and bring the famine to an end. This account is another extensive prophetic scenario, like many we've seen. Let seven of his male descendants be given to us to be killed and exposed before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the Lord's chosen one. So the king said, I will give them to you. 2 Samuel 21, verse 6. But the king took Armoni and Mephibosheth, the two sons of Aiah's daughter Rizpah, whom she had borne to Saul, together with the five sons of Saul's daughter Merab, whom she had borne to Adriel, son of Barzillai the Mahalathite. 2 Samuel 21, verse 8. The seven children are presented to us as the two sons of Rizpah and the five sons of Adriel. It's another 2-5 split. Seven fishermen. In the 21st chapter of John, there is a thrilling and spectacular view of the bride theft. In this scenario, there are seven men in the boat on the Sea of Tiberias. These seven can be divided into two categories: those who are identified and those who are not, which produces a 5-2 split. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. It happened this way: Simon Peter, Thomas, called Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them. And they said, we'll go with you. So they went out and got into the boat. But that night they caught nothing. John 21, verses 1 through 3. Two of the disciples have lead roles in the scenario, Peter and John, while the other five do not, rendering once more the same ratio. Why would the author of the Bible identify such things to us if there weren't some significance? Seven miraculous food items. The feeding of the 5,000 was a miracle and remarkable prophetic scenario that was accomplished with seven food items. This esoteric text illustrates the transition of the ages that occurs at the bride theft. These seven items are in two categories, bread and fish. We have here only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, they answered. Matthew 14, verse 17. This is yet another set of seven with a 5-2 split. In whole numbers, this is how biblical sets of seven items are divided. With regard to the threefold model of great sevens, the Exodus coming at 2,448 from Adam suggests a more granular resolution, a 2.5-4.5 split. This fits perfectly with the way the Holy Day calendar structures the year, with the Prime Shemitah beginning on Yom Terah in 2012. The day appointed for the bride theft follows almost exactly 2.5 years later, which is the 21st day of the first month in 2015. In the Exodus, the Sea of Reeds was crossed on the 21st day of the first month, concluding the very first Pesah in a foreshadowing of the bride theft. The tradition of the midpoint division. It's widely believed that the 7 years is divided right in the middle. The basis for this 3.5-3.5 split theory is a single verse of Scripture. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1-7. In the middle of the 7, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering, and on a wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation, until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. Daniel 9, verse 27. The word translated middle is katsi. It does not demand that we interpret it here as dividing the period into equal portions, because of what we know about the harmony of the threefold model of great sevens. If a major event divides this week of years, it will be modeled in both the creation and millennial weeks. So, do these patterns exhibit a midpoint division? No, they don't. What dramatic event can be found at the midpoint of the fourth millennial day? If there was such a significant event around 500 BC, it would be easy to identify. Take a look. I found nothing at that point in the history of the entire world that has potential, and nothing that looks like a shadow of what is called in Daniel the abomination of desolation. Consider the fourth day of the creation week. The most basic architectural structure of the fourth day account is a two-part division. However, the second is merely a repetition of the first. See the interactive display of thematic structure in Genesis 1, verses 14 through 18. No distinction in character is made in the two halves, like we see in the divided third day. With eyes that have been opened to see the Lord's calendar patterns, it should be clear that the tradition of a midpoint division is weakly supported at best. It will be seen that the division in the midst of the Shemitah week matches the major division in the midst of the millennial week at the 4-3 divide, as the fourth day transitions into the fifth. The first Advent divider, 4 and 3. According to the threefold model of great sevens, it should be anticipated that the transition between the fourth and fifth watches of the night should be substantial. We look for some kind of event or sequence of events that has been foreshadowed in the bringing forth of the sun in creation and in the coming of the Messiah. In this point in the unfolding of the night watches, it may be appointed for what is called the abomination of desolation. I don't have revelation insight on this, and the possible evidence seems pretty sparse, but this seems to be a fair suggestion. As I write, we're approaching this time on the calendar, so we're practicing some informed watching to see what we might see. This event called the Abomination of Desolation seems to rank right up there with Armageddon in popularity, known to most anyone who has ever heard a sermon on Bible prophecy. I suspect it has to do with the arrival of the Mark of the Beast. We find what is perhaps the most popular warning about this event in Matthew's Gospel. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. Matthew 24, verses 15 through 22. That's the kind of dramatic transition in character we might expect to correlate with the rather dramatic 4-3 split seen in the other two kinds of weeks. An abomination has to do with idols, idolatry, the worship of something in place of God. The abomination of, or that causes, desolation may compare to the creation of the sun and the coming of HaMashiach as some manner of the appearance of a counterfeit sun, an anti-sun, Antichrist. This can't be the revealing of the lawless one recorded in 2 Thessalonians 2 from about a year and a half earlier, but perhaps it pertains to the image of the beast receiving life and the full implementation of the mark of the beast, where people provide their bodies as hosts for the spirits of those dead who had been destroyed in the great flood of Noah's day and were reserved for judgment as agents appointed to execute it. And it was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast would even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, the small and the great, and the rich and the poor, and the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. And he provides that no one will be able to buy or to sell, except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Revelation 13, verses 15 through 17. As noted in the study called Resurrection on the Third Day, the seventh day may well be accounted as a third day. This bears witness to the week having a second starting point. The second count begins at this 4-3 divider, as the fourth ends and the fifth watch of the night begins. That there is a secondary count that begins at this time reveals that it's a new beginning. You can perceive the theme, right? I don't really know what to expect, not having it on Revelation Insight, but whatever is coming at this point in the watches of the night looks pretty ominous and of enormous significance. The Shabbat Divider, 6 and 1. The creation week pattern of 6 units of work followed by 1 of rest was extended to another type of week in Leviticus 25. The Lord said to Moses on Mount Sinai, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you enter the land I'm going to give you, the land itself must observe a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years sow your fields, and for 6 years prune your vineyards and gather their crops. But in the 7th year the land is to have a Sabbath of rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Do not sow your fields or prune your vineyards. Do not reap what grows of itself, or harvest the grapes of your untended vines. The land is to have a year of rest. Whatever the land yields during the Sabbath year will be food for you, for yourself, your manservant and maidservant, and the hired worker and temporary resident who live among you, as well as for your livestock and the wild animals in your land. Whatever the land produces may be eaten." Leviticus 25, verses 1 through 7. This cycling set of 7 years is known as the Shemitah cycle, Shemitah referring to the Shabbat year of rest. If you have become familiar with the subject of the harvest allegory, you may note that this agricultural cycle prophesies of the redemption of the creation, including mankind, and the eventual restoration of all things. This resting in the seventh day is a primary theme of the seventh watch in the night, too. Another is the execution of judgment, where the wrath of God is visited upon the disobedient, and peace and rest is brought to their persecuted victims. The following passages are often interpreted in the context of the millennial week, but do they not also apply to a literal day and to a literal year? For the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of retribution, to uphold Zion's cause. Isaiah 34, verse 8. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redemption has come. I looked, but there was no one to help. I was appalled that no one gave support. So my own arm worked salvation for me, and my own wrath sustained me. I trampled the nations in my anger. In my wrath I made them drunk and poured their blood on the ground. Isaiah 63, verses 4 through 6. After this I looked, and in heaven the temple, that is, the tabernacle of the testimony, was opened. Out of the temple came the 7 angels with the 7 plagues. They were dressed in clean, shining linen, and wore golden sashes around their chests. Then one of the 4 living creatures gave to the 7 angels 7 golden bowls filled with the wrath of God, who lives forever and ever. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God, from his power. And no one could enter the temple until the 7 plagues of the 7 angels were completed. Then I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the 7 angels, "Go, pour out the 7 bowls of God's wrath on the earth." Revelation 15, verse 5 through chapter 16, verse 1. The great day of the Lord is near, near and coming quickly. Listen, the cry on the day of the Lord will be bitter, the shouting of the warrior there. That day will be a day of wrath, a day of distress and anguish, a day of trouble and ruin, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and blackness, a day of trumpet and battle cry against the fortified cities and against the corner towers. I will bring distress on the people, and they will walk like blind men, because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood will be poured out like dust, and their entrails like filth. Neither their silver nor their gold will be able to save them on the day of the Lord's wrath. In the fire of his jealousy the whole world will be consumed, for he will make a sudden end of all who live in the earth. Gather together, O shameful nation, before the appointed time arrives and that day sweeps on like chaff, before the fierce anger of the Lord comes upon you, before the day of the Lord's wrath comes upon you. Seek the Lord, all you humble of the land, you who do what he commands. Seek righteousness, seek humility. Perhaps you will be sheltered on the day of the Lord's anger. Zephaniah 1, verses 14 through chapter 2, verse 3. But your dead will live, their bodies will rise. You who dwell in the dust, wake up and shout for joy. Your dew is like the dew of the morning. The earth will give birth to her dead. Go, my people, enter your rooms and shut the doors behind you. Hide yourselves for a little while, until his wrath is passed by. See, the Lord is coming out of his dwelling to punish the people of the earth for their sins. The earth will disclose the blood shed upon her. She will conceal her slain no longer. Isaiah 26, verses 19 through 21. This year day Shemitah will be a rest year for the remaining people of God, as they are protected and cared for, but in contrast, a season of wrath for others. I believe there is a literal 24-hour kind of day most particularly appointed for the conclusion of the wrath, and that there is also a year appointed for retribution. The Lord calls this the year of his redemption. That year will also be a year of the Lord's favor, similar to when Yeshua proclaimed its fulfillment in Luke 4, verses 18 and 19, and further applying to those who would come after his kind, who will grieve in Zion, and upon whom the Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives, and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, and provide for those who grieve in Zion, to bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. Isaiah 61, verses 1 through 3. I will close this section with an interesting view where the night watches are metaphorically calamities. Blessed is the man whom God corrects, so do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he also binds up. He injures, but his hands also heal. From six calamities he will rescue you. In seven, no harm will befall you. In famine, he will ransom you from death. And in battle, from the stroke of the sword. Job 5, verses 17 through 20. The Hebrew word for rescue is natzal, meaning the same as rapture. This is not a pre, mid, post-tribulation rapture. This truth should become very obvious as you make your way through the compilation of studies. The Shemitah ends. When the prime Shemitah comes to an end, the Yobel, or Jubilee, will be celebrated as a fulfillment of long-standing prophecy beginning with Yom Kippur. The night portion of the seventh millennial day will have passed. The dawn of the day will be celebrated in the earth as the reign of the triumphant line of the tribe of Judah is established. Those glorious passages that picture his millennial reign will be manifest. He will be known as both sovereign and just. He will be vindicated, and those with him. Glory. This concludes our presentation of the Night of Seven Watches. Thank you for listening.